2nd Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, John D. Johnson, president of the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, delivered the annual State of the Tribes address this afternoon. We'll find out what was in the speech. First, for the sixth straight year, the U.S. birth rate declined in 2020, this time by 4%. In December, about 9 months after the start of the pandemic, births had declined by about 8% compared with the December of the year prior. It's not just the pandemic. This year's numbers appear to be a part of an ongoing trend. But why? You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you're at a stage in your life where having kids is something you're thinking about, what is the decision process like for you? And no matter where you are right now, if you chose to have kids or chose not to, tell us what went into that. Did you ever have doubts? If you're a young person, are you hoping or planning to have kids someday? Why not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Christine Whelan is a clinical professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison, where she teaches classes on happiness and well-being, and is also the founding director of the Money, Relationships, and Equality Initiative. She's a speaker and author of several books, including a new audiobook, Finding Your Purpose. Christine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
I've seen a lot of really simple answers, Christine, to the decline in birth rates in the United States. I'm guessing it's more complicated than any one answer, though. What do you think?
Absolutely. We're all an experiment of one. And so while we can see some big trends historically, and we certainly can see some trends in the last year, the choice to have a child is a sign of hope for the future. And, you know, everything from the global pandemic to economic issues to people's individual choice, it may not always be a time of optimism.
There was some speculation early on in the pandemic that there could be a baby boom coming out of it. I guess we didn't have anything better to do, weren't going anywhere. Maybe we would take this time to settle down and have kids. That doesn't clearly seem to have panned out, at least according to the early results. And people pointed out there are a lot of reasons that it might not have worked out that way. Can you look at that balance?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as I was joking with people at the time, you know, we're all on top of each other, but not in the way that makes babies during those early months of the pandemic. And the truth is that when there is a fear of contagion, when there is a fear of something scary out there that we don't understand, that tends not to be the time when people think it's a great idea to bring new life into the world. So people were delaying having kids. Anybody who was needing assisted reproductive technologies to have their kid could not do that during the months of the lockdown. So we see a sort of decline in the birth rate, a huge one, really, an 8% decline in the month of December of 2020. But really, we're looking right now at the lowest birth rate since 1979. So this is not just a pandemic issue.
Do you look at a declining birth rate and see a value judgment in that? Is this good news or bad news, Christine, or is it what we make of it?
Well, it is what we make of it. So one good thing is that teen birth rates are down. They're down 63% since 2007. And that generally, most people can agree, is a good thing. Women are also having kids a lot later. The average age at first birth now is 27, which is really up a lot, substantially from where it was in 2010. It was at 23 just 11 years ago. So we see average age at first birth increasing dramatically. And you could say that that's a good thing if people are more financially able to support a child and are doing it at a time where they feel like they're really welcoming and ready to add a new addition to their family.
Talking to Christine Whelan from the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison, looking at declining birth rates in the United States. December to December last year, a pretty big drop during the pandemic, but it's not just a pandemic story. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on this, with your questions, maybe your own experience on making the decision whether or not to have kids in the last year, in the last 10 years, or at any point in your life. 800-642-1234. 1-2-3-4 is the number to call. Christine, pre-pandemic, one story I saw anyway was that, okay, we had the Great Recession, and that was a huge setback for this cohort of, I think, millennials still, hitting the job market, not getting great jobs, not feeling secure if they had a college education, lots of debt without the jobs to pay for it. And that was going to be a setback for the decision to have kids. Is that part of what's going on here, do you think?
Yes, certainly. Economic impact is a really big one. And the decision to not have children or to substantially delay having children has economic impact as well, because currently we are below replacement rates with our birth rate, which means that more people are dying than being born. And that has an impact on Social Security payments, something that economists call the age dependency ratio. But, you know, we can also have immigration as a balancing factor. So a lower birth rate does not necessarily mean doom and gloom, but it is certainly an indicator of people looking at the economy and the future in a different way.
For if you go back a couple few generations, the idea of it being a decision to have kids might sound kind of like an alien concept. Could you talk about how times have changed in that way that we think of having kids more and more as a yes or no decision, as opposed to an expectation that just about everybody's going to have kids?
Yes, and I am uniquely qualified to answer this question, because in 1975, my mother, Dr. Elizabeth Whelan, who was an epidemiologist, wrote a book called A Baby Maybe, A Guide to Making the Most Fateful Decision of Your Life. And it was a bestseller. It sold more than 1 million copies, because this was really the first generation of women who could choose whether they wanted to pursue a career or whether they wanted to be moms or to do both. And my mother and father, in fact, were trying to decide whether or not to have a baby. And in the course of doing the interviews for that book, my mother decided to have me. So I, in fact, am the baby maybe. And so this whole decision about whether or not to have a child is one that is very personal, but really going back not too far, this was not something that people were choosing in the way they are now. So it's a historical change.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Sierra is with us in Wautoma. Sierra, hi.
Hi there. Hi. I am a full-time working mom, and I'm in nurse practitioner school, and my fiance works full-time. And the reason we're postponing having any more kids is because of the lack of childcare. There's only about 3 licensed daycare providers in our area, and there's wait lists for years. So that's one thing that's definitely keeping us from having any more younger ones that need full-time daycare.
Wow. Sierra, have you thought about moving to another area? I don't know if there's a magical place in the country where there's tons and tons of childcare, but are you thinking of relocating to a spot to where you could find childcare?
That would make it even harder. My fiance works second shift, so I have to work first shift and everything else. So it's kind of just me when he's working. So I have to make sure I have, you know, stable childcare for, and then his family is definitely really helpful when it comes to if I have to work, you know, extra overtime or things like that.
Interesting. Sierra, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Sierra, Christine, I'm guessing not alone, that concern about where am I going to find childcare?
Absolutely. Childcare is a huge issue. It is very expensive, and it is hard to find good, reliable childcare. And, you know, yet the economics of childcare are quite difficult as well, because from the childcare provider's perspective, they feel that they are not getting paid nearly enough. And so there isn't the incentive to go into the childcare industry. Yet if we pay childcare folks more, then who is going to foot the bill? Because parents are already scraping to make ends meet to pay for this childcare. So other countries have government subsidies for childcare, and that may be something that the United States looks at in the future. And I do think that would have an impact on birth rates as well.
Thanks again for that call, Sierra. And Christine, I should throw into the mix now, government policy here. I know a lot of people compare things like family leave policy between the United States and, say, a lot of Western Europe. What kind of things do you look at there in terms of how that affects that decision to have a kid or not?
Yeah, we're the only developed nation in the world that does not have a full federal paid family leave program. Right now, if you work at a company with fewer than 50 employees, You do not have to necessarily get any leave whatsoever. And it's not necessarily paid leave for many folks. It's just some job security, but only for 12 weeks. So these are really difficult. These are difficult economic conditions into which to have a child for many people. And this is something that politicians talk about a lot. Can we add incentives, either incentives in terms of childcare or really financial and tax incentives to have more children? And is that a good thing for our country? Or do we want to open up the gates for immigration and invite other people into the country rather than from other countries, rather than having more children of our own?
Christine Whelan is with us, clinical professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison, where she teaches classes on happiness and well-being. We're talking about what goes into the decision of whether or not to have children and the declining birth rate in the U.S. over the last handful of years. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you making this decision right now, deciding when and if to have children? What kind of factors are going into that for you? If you've made that decision in the past, what tipped the scales one way or another? Or was it an easy choice? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Christine Whelan, clinical professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. We're talking about the ongoing decline in the U.S. birth rate, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you made a decision? Are you making the decision these days about when and if to have kids and how many? What are the factors weighing for or against that right now for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Rich is with us in Burlington. Rich, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering with the abortion being legalized since 1973, and last count I saw there was about 62 million abortions in our country, somewhere around the rate of 1.1 million abortions a year. With the termination of that many children, how is that affecting the birth rate in our country, and do you see that as a good thing, or how do you see that?
Thanks for that call, Rich. I pulled up some CDC numbers here. It's a little over 600,000 in the most recent year they've got up for 2018. And there had been declines from 2011 to 2018. Christine, throwing that out there, does the abortion rate in the U.S. have a big impact on the overall birth rate?
Yeah, so abortion rates have been declining. Really, I think what we are seeing is an increase in contraceptive use among young people, especially, and we see childbearing as a choice that people are making much more intentionally and at older ages. You know, the only age group where we see the birth rate increasing is women in their mid to late 40s. I mean, these are the women who are probably using in vitro fertilization and other assisted reproductive technologies to have children, and very actively working toward it. So for the most part, we really see having a child not as an outcome of unprotected sex, but as a choice to bring new life into the world. And I think there's really some wonderful optimism and hope associated with that.
Thanks for the call, Rich, at 800-642-1234. We'll bring on Maria now, calling from Maquonago. Maria, hi.
Yes, hello. So no one's mentioned the fact that fertility and sperm counts have gone down drastically, and no one knows quite. There's a brand new book out called Countdown that sperm counts have dropped about 50% in the last 50 years. And so there's the questions about whether there's exposures in our environment, plastics and things have affecting our endocrine systems and so affecting fertility. So that hasn't been mentioned yet today.
Maria, thanks for the call. And Christine, I know I've seen headlines along those things, and I'll admit I haven't dug deeply. Is that something you've had your eye on?
Yeah, so I've been following this research. It's very interesting. It does not explain the large-scale declines in the birth rate that we have seen over the last decades. But it is an interesting thing to watch. When there are people who have issues trying to conceive, we do see more and more people heading toward this assisted reproductive technology world. And that in part is because the technology is there in a way that it wasn't two generations ago. And potentially, that could be because more people are having challenges having kids. However, all of that said, that does not explain the large decline in the birth rate. Really, these are big trends over time. And while everybody's decision is unique and individual, there are big factors like economics, like childcare, like the role of women and the role of caregivers and who is going to be in that role and whether that role is something that is valued in our society. These are these big seismic shifts that are bigger probably than the biological changes that may certainly be happening, but that people then are choosing to use technology to fix.
Thanks for the question, Maria. We're talking to Christine Whelan from UW-Madison, looking at declining birth rates in the United States over the last 7 or so years. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Frank is with us, driving near Merrill. Frank, hi.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear. What's up, Frank?
Well, I just wanted to say my son, who's about 33, just announced his wife is pregnant for the first child, which is, we're very excited about. But I jokingly asked if he was getting some parental leave, and I was surprised that the answer is yes. His company's giving him 6 weeks because he works for a major pharmaceutical company, but the irony is she's a physical therapist, and she gets no paid time off. So I just thought in 2018, we were in Europe, in Amsterdam, or in Germany, and there was a husband there in a coffee shop that said that he gets 6 months off. Him and his wife got 6 months off of pregnancy.
Frank, thanks a lot for sharing that story. Congratulations to your family, by the way. And Christine, the dad getting family leave here, is that getting to be more common?
It is, yes. And the wonderful part is that we are calling it family leave, not maternity leave, and the language really matters here. So yes, there are more and more large companies that are offering this leave. Now, there is the sort of social challenge that some men are considered not so serious about their job or their career path if they take this leave. And so we still have some work to do in terms of encouraging managers and others to really respect this leave as something that is good and a good investment in the future. But in this particular caller's story, this is really tough. So the woman who's working as a physical therapist gets no paid time off. And that is an all too common reality for so many mothers. So we are the only really developed nation that does not have a paid family leave system. And you can take it from both sides. It would be very good for us to have some federally subsidized paid family leave. At the same time, that, who's going to pay for it? And if you mandate it for small businesses, are some small businesses going to be unable to keep the doors open? So these are complex economic issues.
Thanks for that call, Frank. Hannah joins us next in Viroqua. Hannah, hello.
Hi. My comment was just that the IPCC report, which was a 2018 climate report, definitely impacted my decision to not have more than one child. That's all.
Hannah, can I ask before you sign off, was it a fear of what the world's going to look like for your kids or worry about the environmental impact of having more kids or a little of both?
a little of both.
Hannah, thanks a lot for the call. This isn't the first time I've heard this, Christine, from people. We've talked to a couple guests over the years who've said they held off on kids or decided not to because of climate change.
You know, this is something that I think we have to take really seriously. And it is, it's a big issue. The amount of resources that an affluent child will use in the course of his or her lifetime is just enormous. And so if you are worried about the impact on the environment, then certainly, you know, having fewer children will have less of an environmental footprint and impact. You know, at the same time, then you may worry about what world you are going to leave to your children and whether they will have a less bright future than you are having because of the decline in the environmental world around us. You know, this is potentially why we may not see a baby boom after the pandemic. You know, births tend to kind of dip after economic crises and wars during those tough times, and then they tend to come back. So during the, you know, births dropped sharply during the Great Depression and the stock market crash, but then it picked up afterwards, and then we had the baby boom. But we did not see a similar baby boom after the Great Recession in 2008, even though the economy improved. And I'm not sure we're going to see a post-pandemic baby boom either. And those global environmental concerns certainly may be part of the reason.
Christine, I want to have a whole conversation about this sometime, but just real quick, we've got an economy based on a growing population and lots of Western countries and others seeing a declining population. Do we need to start rethinking about how our economy works to account for this change?
Yes. So one way to deal with what we call the age dependency ratio is to invite and open our borders to allow more immigration. And that is something that I think a lot of people are talking about. So we can think about that. Certainly other people are thinking about economic changes in terms of robotics and artificial intelligence and what, you know, whether we need fewer humans and more robots. There are all sorts of ways to approach these questions, but it's really good to think about them and talk about them right now.
Christine, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Christine Whelan is a clinical professor in the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. She's also founding director of the Money, Relationships, and Equality Initiative and the author of books including Finding Your Purpose. She joined us to talk about the ongoing decline in birth rates in the U.S. Coming up after the news, we'll recap today's State of the Tribes address and look at some of the issues highlighted in the speech before state lawmakers. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, last year's SolarWinds attack and this week's news about a hacked fuel pipeline in the U.S. are raising big concerns about cybersecurity in the business world. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at vulnerabilities here in the U.S. and what it all means for our daily lives. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the 17th annual State of the Tribes address was delivered this afternoon by John Johnson Sr., president of the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. In the speech, Johnson tackled issues like treaty rights, the economic health of the sovereign nations in Wisconsin, a call to change school mascots, and more. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you listen to or watch the speech? What stood out to you? What issues resonated with you today? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Mary Annette Pember is a national correspondent for Indian Country Today. She's also a citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Wisconsin Ojibwe. Mary Annette, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, what stood out to you particularly about the address today?
Well, I think the things that you'd mentioned, and also, you know, these are racial disparities in the legal system in Wisconsin. I think Native men are likely to draw prison sentences at like the highest rate of any ethnicity, something like 34%. Also, the Wisconsin Regional Mental Health and Treatment Facility that he spoke of, and the governor, I think, has allocated $12.3 million for two new regional crisis centers. Executive Order 39, affirming government-to-government relationships between tribes and states, underscoring tribal sovereignty. Walleye fishing and spearing, ongoing issue. You know, and just the importance of natural resources for our Native people. The other thing I noticed was a mention of Senate Bill 69 requiring Wisconsin schools, I guess now it's Act 30, requiring schools to incorporate lessons regarding the Holocaust and other genocides. And Chairman Johnson suggested that included in those genocides might be something like the Sandy Lake tragedy of 1850, in which like about 400 Ojibwe died while being lured to Wisconsin for government rations. Missing and murdered Indigenous women, that's certainly a national issue. And I understand that Wisconsin Department of Justice has allocated like $300,000 to address that. Mascots, that's still, you know, I think that hasn't gotten enough traction yet to retire all, requiring a law, you know, requiring schools to retire those kinds of Native mascots. There's only a few states that have enacted those laws. And I think that's really, those are the kind of the things that stood out to me.
And we'll dig deeper into some of those issues. One overarching theme, and this is something I hear often in these State of the Tribes addresses, is kind of state-tribal relations 101, with the idea that people might look at what are treaty-established rights and thinking they were, you know, special gifts or special privileges given to Native Americans. John Johnson Sr. today talking about, no, these are things that were negotiated and defined in treaties. These are obligations, I guess, from the U.S. or the state government. Can you talk about that and how it's misunderstood sometimes?
Yes. I mean, I think that a lot of people have the sort of view that Native people have, quote unquote, special rights. But, you know, I recall working on a story and interviewing a Native elder actually in South Dakota. And he said to me, you know, when he worked quite often with non-Native people in the construction industry. And he said when the people would make those comments, he would say, you know, if your relatives had negotiated an agreement with the U.S. government, I bet you'd have that agreement laminated and in your back pocket, ready to pull out in case, you know, you thought that any of your rights were being overlooked. And I think that's probably an astute look, a view of that. These are things that our people negotiated. And, you know, we gave up, our ancestors gave up a great deal of land. During the course of that, actually, we're not afforded all of the promises that we were given. For instance, the rights to hunt, fish, and gather in the ceded territory. That only finally was verified by the Voight decision, I think like in the late 70s, early 80s. So before that time, you know, Native people on reservations in Wisconsin sometimes were subject to the same state hunting and fishing laws that the rest of the population was. And Native people in particular, with their low incomes, depend on subsistence hunting and gathering to live. So that's a little bit of background on that, I think.
We're talking to Mary Annette Pember, national correspondent for Indian Country Today, looking at today's State of the Tribes address delivered to the state legislature this year by the president of the Lac du Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, John Johnson Sr. Want to give a listen as we start to dig into some of the particular issues you listed earlier. President Johnson here early in the speech talking about addiction treatment options in his tribe, drug enforcement efforts, especially as it pertains to opioids. Here's a listen.
Fentanyl and meth remain an issue that impacts our entire region. Drugs are killing people in northern Wisconsin and across the country. Drugs don't discriminate.
And this, Mary, is one issue that doesn't just affect members of tribes in Wisconsin or the rest of the population. This is one that kind of cuts across all boundaries, as President Johnson was saying there. What kind of issues do you look at when it comes to addiction and the opioid addiction problem in particular?
Well, I think especially for Native people, it kind of underscores the lack of resources we might have medically, you know, for mental health, and just our, you know, kind of our inadequate infrastructure. So often we are keenly affected, I think, by that. And I, you know, I've seen some numbers that the pandemic really has contributed to higher rates of use, you know, as people have been cooped up and you know, there's little to do, and plus people lost jobs. I mean, it's been kind of a perfect storm, I think, for a lot of people, and it's a big issue in rural Wisconsin. I think that as Chairman Johnson noted, that cuts across nationalities.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Nancy is with us in Minocqua. Nancy, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I listen every year when I can, and that I feel that this state of the tribes should be live streamed into our school systems across Wisconsin, because we have a large Native population. And I think that it would get rid of a lot of the misinformation that a lot of the Caucasian white people have about the treaties, about the spearing, about the Native's rights. And I just find it so interesting. I listened to the entire thing today.
Nancy, thanks for calling in and sharing that. Mary, your thoughts? Nancy would like to have the speech more widely heard, including in schools. And I think maybe just more education on these issues in general.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think there was... Wasn't there a bill enacted in the 80s requiring schools to teach more Native history? And, Act 31 adopted in 89. How many people even know how many tribes are in Wisconsin? There are 11 tribes. People are often surprised at that. Unless you live, and even people who live immediately adjacent to reservations, I'm often shocked at their lack of awareness. And I wonder, what precipitates that? I guess, one, the lack of education in schools. You know, Natives are really cast as a denizens of sort of a dead past, but we aren't really framed in the current culture. So, yeah, I think that, we need to encourage state schools to include those lessons on history and culture and contemporary Native life.
Nancy, thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. You mentioned, Mary, environmental issues. President Johnson said, made the case that at this time anyway, heavy metal mining in the state should be, quote, rejected as a threat to all, end quote. He was referring to a mine near the Lac des Flambeaux area. This is a question in other parts of the Great Lakes. What do you make of what he had to say about mining in the state?
Well, Wisconsin really owes their mining laws pre-Governor Walker, I think, to tribes. If we look back at Mole Lake and their rejection of Rio Tinto zinc, I think, if I'm remembering the name correctly, it was really the use of treaty rights. They were able to keep those people out. And those that kind of mining, particularly, in Minnesota, they're pursuing these copper mines. And even now the new taconite mining to mine these lower quality iron ores, they release a lot of sulfides that have a very negative impact, I think, on our waterways, on fish and wild rice. So, I mean, it has for everybody. Everybody requires water and to exist. And, I think that people often see these as, quote, unquote, tribal issues, but they aren't. They're human issues.
Let's go to another caller now. Adam is with us in Madison. Adam, hi.
Hi there. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I'd like to just kind of make a comment and a question as far as, like, how public media and what their role is in giving Native peoples in Wisconsin the opportunity to tell their own stories and their own voices. So, like, for instance, Wisconsin Public Television, Wisconsin Public Radio, versus, I know in Canada there is quite a bit of public arts funding and public media funding dedicated to giving Native First Nations people there those opportunities.
Thanks a lot for the call. And I can't speak myself to the things we've done in the past, but your thoughts on that, Mary, the role of public media in working maybe with tribal organizations to talk more about these issues?
Well, I think, Wisconsin has done a very good job, particularly in their public media. I worked in mainstream media for years before I joined Indian Country Today. And some of the reason I left mainstream media was that I was really forbidden from covering Native issues for the most part. I was discouraged on the basis that I would lack sufficient objectivity to cover Native issues because I'm a Native woman. And I remember countering an editor with the comment, you know, I noticed you're sending off white men, white male reporters to cover City Hall, you know, politicians there for the most part are white men, and yet you don't seem to have any concerns about their maintaining their objectivity. Unfortunately, I think, you know, mainstream media is, you know, it's another institution in this country. And, you know, I think many of the quote unquote, you know, accepted tenets of journalism, aside from, of course, one wants to be accurate and true. But I think, you know, every journalist comes to this work with a perspective. And the sort of embraced perspective has always been that of, you know, of white folks versus people of color. And I think, you know, it's you know, I started in this business in 1986, and I haven't really seen a lot of changes regarding hiring. And I think it goes far deeper than hiring, just hiring a person of color and throwing them into this mix where, you know, we still have these same mentalities. I don't know if it really makes that much difference. I mean, mainstream media does require some very basic changes, I think, to the way that they cover the world and people of color.
Adam, thanks for the call. We're talking to Mary Annette Pember, national correspondent for Indian Country Today, citizen of the Red Cliff Band of Wisconsin Ojibwe, and we're looking at today's State of the Tribes address. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Did you listen to or watch the address this afternoon? If you are a citizen of a tribe yourself, what stood out to you in this speech? What wasn't there that you wish was there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the 17th Annual State of the Tribes Address. Our guest is Mary Annette Pember, national correspondent for Indian Country Today. You could join in with your reactions to today's speech at 800-642-1234. We heard today about the persistence of racism faced by Native Americans. President Johnson talked about encountering that himself and hoping his grandkids wouldn't have to be talking about the same thing down the road. Here's a listen to some of what he had to say about that.
I don't really know how to explain it because, you know, I've had to endure it when I was in school and the service and everything else. But you know what? I don't want to tell these guys about it because it's hateful. You know, it's something we got to fix.
And Mary, I understand from the transcript that was an unscripted part of Johnson's speech and a powerful moment in it. Can you talk about his reference to his experiences there?
I couldn't quite hear him when he said that he didn't want to share, I think, the details with his children. Was that what he said?
That he didn't want to share it here, I think, today, but talking about enduring racism in the school and in military service and beyond.
Yeah, I think, you know, most of us as Native people have gotten those, had those experiences. And it does sort of chip away at you, you know, it does undermine you. And but I think we do have to, you know, talk to our children about it. You know, how do you continue to hold your head up high? How do you respond? How do you not let it chip away at you? And I think that until you've had that kind of thing happen to you, you really don't fully understand it. I know I've, in my work with mainstream media, I just was, as I thought of it now, I was recalling, there was an editor, a white male editor, he's very good. And he was always just very dismissive of, you know, people's claims of racial prejudice. But his daughter, you know, married a black man and they had a child. And of course, he quite loved the grandchild. And he would see the child's, you know, people's reactions sometimes out in public. And, you know, until you feel that, I think, you know, it cuts to your heart and it comes in a personal way, you can't really, you can't really appreciate it in a true sense.
Do we have, Mary, you think, enough venues to talk across the lines of race and culture about these issues so that you don't wait, you don't have to wait until you have a kid of color if you're a white person to start to appreciate these issues?
A short answer, no. But how do we make them? Man, you got me. I don't know. Some people just, you know, to be a white person in America is to have the luxury of choice. You know, not saying, I mean, there's a lot of white people that are poor. However, you know, I mean, one, I think, as I said, you have that luxury of choice. You get to, you can choose to ignore it or for not to be important to your lives. But, you know, people of color, should we choose to ignore it, sooner or later, somebody will present us with it. So we don't have that. that luxury. So, and as far as, how does one, awaken people? I don't know if that can be forced on people. People have to have a desire first. And I think we're in a place now, often we have people who feel, I think a lot of people are feeling wrongly accused, about something that they feel they had no responsibility for, something that happened in the past. And I think that's just sort of it's kind of a knee-jerk reaction that people are having, which is not surprising. It's very human. How do you get people to get past that? I really don't know. I don't know what to tell you. I guess just to continue to talk about it, as uncomfortable as it is.
And turning back to environmental issues, Mary, I understand you mentioned to our producer you were surprised that, or you thought it was interesting anyway, that the Enbridge pipeline concern didn't get brought up in today's State of the Tribes address. Could you talk a little bit about that issue and why you thought it was interesting that it wasn't there in the speech today?
Well, I think that's one of the things to remember when we hear the State of the Tribes address. It's kind of like hearing, a presidential address or the State of Wisconsin address. I mean, presumably that would be given by somebody who would have a political leaning. Well, Native people are no different than anyone else. I mean, these folks, tribal leaders are politicians, and they might have certain issues that they would care to avoid. And I think, Enbridge has been in Wisconsin, has been a little thorny. Bad River has sued Enbridge and has demanded they remove the old Line 5 from the reservation and compensate them. And they're currently, that's currently a lawsuit that's ongoing versus some other tribes of particular, I think, Lac-Ta-Couturier tribe actually, they sold an easement to Enbridge, and they've received relatively recently, their fifth payment, for their right of way lease. We're not really seeing people, tribes claiming that, that there's unified force supporting Bad River in this lawsuit and in their relationship with Enbridge.
I want to spend a couple minutes, as President Johnson did, on spearfishing and treaty rights. He talked about it at some length, and maybe people forget this was before my time in Wisconsin, just the bitter, I think, anger that white people had when, as you said, that court ruling came down enforcing the treaty rights of Native Americans in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Can you talk about how that issue is still relevant to be brought up today?
Yes, I was a young reporter at the Green Bay Press Gazette when that first emerged, and it was a difficult time to be a Native journalist. I had some difficulty covering that issue. I would sometimes be refused service at various businesses. People felt, again, when we talked earlier about this perception that Native people have quote unquote special rights, I think that was the overwhelming view of those who were opposed to Native people, taking advantage of their treaty rights in the ceded territories, particularly spearing. And I know there has been an argument that, well, Native people are going to spear, they should use, the technology that predates European contact, which is, an argument that this does not make any sense. It doesn't play out in the sense that one wouldn't expect, people that support gun laws to, to talk about, munitions that were in use, when they wrote the Constitution. I mean, nobody's talking about using flintlocks, so it doesn't hold water, this argument. But people still feel, I think, quite strongly that Native people have special rights, even though, despite the fact that the tribal harvest is quite a bit lower. I did see a DNR study that sports anglers took between 26,000 and 300,000 walleye from lakes declared for spearing between 2008 and 2012 versus 31,000 in 2012, or an average of 157,000 over a five-year period for Native spearers. So, it's a very small amount. But I think it just, it must, sort of stick in some people's craws that Native people are able to do this.
We'll leave it there for now. Mary, thanks again for joining us today.
No, thank you for having me.
Mary Annette Pember is a national correspondent for Indian Country Today. She joins us today to recap the 17th annual State of the Tribes address delivered today by John Johnson, Sr., president of the Lac-Ta-Flambeau Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. Coming up tomorrow on the morning show, they'll take a close look at treaty rights, including a discussion about the spearfishing issue. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll visit a sober living facility in Milwaukee that's trying to provide a new start for people who are dealing with addiction. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.
Welcome to my house.
Count Dracula.
I am Dracula. Enter freely and of your own will.
Usually it's a real bad idea to accept an invitation from Dracula, played there by Christopher Lee. But this month, there may be an upside. I talked a while back about cool places that people are getting COVID-19 vaccines. Lambeau Field, for example, and other lesser sporting facilities around the world, and the Natural History Museum in New York City under the giant blue whale. But I think Romania is winning now. As reported by CNN, they've opened up a vaccination center at Bran Castle in the Carpathian Mountains. It's often referred to as Dracula's Castle because it's a good match for the castle in the Dracula novel by Bram Stoker. According to some quick internet research, it looks like Stoker never actually visited the castle in person. Now it's a tourist attraction in Romania, especially for fans of the book and all the Dracula movies based, sometimes very loosely, on it. Well, now it's home to a vaccination site each weekend in May as part of an effort to get the locals vaccinated and maybe to appeal to tourists who can add a vaccine to their itinerary. You can get a diploma of vaccination at Dracula's Castle. As an added bonus, you can get a free visit to the exhibition of medieval instruments of torture after your shot. Compared to that, I guess one needle doesn't look so bad. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.